Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 13th of July 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analyst here. Great to have you on board and thank you very much for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. Got Chris Bates ready to come on in just a moment or two. I will just do what I always do, which is just remind you that this is not financial advice. This is a general conversation. Don't take it as such. If you're looking for specific advice, you need a financial advisor. Do play nice in the chat room. We do moderate the stream. No racial slurs, please. This is as of the 13th of July 21. If you want to get my attention, use at Walk the World, just to make sure that I see it. I have also enabled Super Chat, which allows you to get your question to the top of the queue if you would like to do that, or indeed make a contribution to help covering the costs of running the show. We don't do this for profit. We do it because we think it's important. But any support is always very, very welcome. Anyhow, with that introduction, I'm pleased to say that Chris Bates is ready to go. So if I push this button, Chris Bates, are you there?
Martin.
Yay, Eureka, it worked. I always hold my breath when I push that button.
Yeah, you know, no lockdown fail here.
No, that's good. That's good. No, it's good to see you again. And you know, we met a few weeks ago, last time on the live conversation. And you know, things have changed and things have moved on to be much the same, haven't they, in some ways?
Yeah, I think it's. I mean, rates movements around the fixed rates have, I think, scared people a little bit, which is interesting. Even though the variable rates are still, if not lower. Just some of those 3 and 4 year fixed rates and the 5 year fixed rates just jumping a bit. It sort of kind of opened people's eyes that rates are likely to rise at some point. You know, when they were all under 2%, I think it was really like, let's just go to the races. You know, rates are going to be low forever. You know, that was creeping in. You could see that in March and April with some of the behavior at auctions. And I do think that fixed rate has changed people's perceptions a little bit, not dramatically. But just when rates are moving either up or down, people get that recency bias and they're like, well, if they're going to rise now, they're going to keep on rising. And so it's going to be interesting to see if they keep on rising those fixed rates or whether that was just the funding facility ending and now the banks can still get a margin on low 2%. And, obviously the RBA are pretty set on not rising for some time. So, I think that's changing things. I also think that because all properties pretty much all over the country pretty much went up, even the poorer assets, the busier roads, the dark properties, smaller block, weird blocks, you know, things with privacy issue. Well, I think a lot of those were getting huge prices, you know, late last year and early this year. And a lot of clients are saying, look, I don't want to buy those properties. I want to wait. I want to be patient. I don't want to pay all this, you know, this huge price, and just get into the market. A lot of people are saying, actually, you know what, I'll be a little bit patient. I'll wait for the quality assets, which I think that wasn't there earlier in the year and it wasn't there late last year. So I think that's another good thing, also being a bit hesitant around rates.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Cookie Boy just put up the latest listings, right? Listings are down, aren't they? Particularly for houses.
Yeah, I think, there has been low listings. And I think the problem is even a lot of those listings, you probably don't want to buy anyway. And I don't think a lot of quality listings have come on. I think it's unfortunately a lot of upgraders who are in that boat wanting to sell a good asset to buy another good asset. It's like a chicken and egg problem. Like they're not going to list their property unless they're confident they can find another property to upgrade into. So I do think the quality of the listings is actually quite low as well. But what was quite scary, I think, is, you know, those properties that, you know, shouldn't really sell that well, have been selling, you know, in that last 6 months, because a lot of the older listings have been going down in the cities. And I do think that's going to creep up again, even though we've got this lockdown, even though we've got this, I do think a lot of people are going to say, oh, even though rates are low, I really want to get into the market. I'm not going to buy the poor things because they're expensive, because they've gone up so much over the last 12 months. I don't think that desperation is going to be back for some time personally.
Interesting, right. And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is the contradiction between units and houses are still showing up in my data. You know, the movements in unit prices, particularly in some inner suburban areas around Sydney and Melbourne, are still going in the wrong direction relative to houses. Houses in regional centres, houses on large blocks, up end of the market, still very strong.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the premium end, then you've got the houses that are a little bit further away from the city than traditionally people wanted to go. We're definitely still seeing that, you know, the upper, you know, the Hornsby pocket still very attractive to buyers, and people weren't willing to go there. You know, the Shire, we had a couple of people buying the Shire in the last week that, you know, aren't from the Shire, but they're going down there because it's, you know, much better value than, you know, in that mid one sort of range. It's interesting. We saw a lot of clients in 2020 go to the regions. You know, it's very well publicised out there. And in particular, you know, north of Wollongong near you, Martin, we had heaps of clients.
Oh, yes.
Also in Central Coast. But, you know, when they were going there, they wanted to go to those sort of lifestyle areas because they were much more affordable to lifestyle locations in the capital city. And they were like, work from home forever, etc. But those areas like near our Newmarton, you've gone up a lot. You know, it's hard to sort of put a percentage on it, but I would say it's well over 30, 40% in these areas. And they're no longer that much more affordable than, say, their Sydney alternative. And I do feel people are a little bit more concerned around that return to work, hybrid working model. You know, that's a big discussion still going on. You know, is it 2 days? Is it 3 days? And so we've seen a lot of those people who would have gone to the regions in 2020 are actually back in the city buying apartments. And so where you're looking at your data, Martin, if you cut that down from the high density areas where you've got lots of investors playing, lots of new building, the high supply areas, versus the more established premium end where your apartments in them, those apartments in those premium areas where they're not building any more apartments will be going through the roof. So the beaches, you know, the good parts of the eastern suburbs, you know, around the lower North Shore, because a lot of, you know, the buyers that want to buy houses, that can't afford houses because they're too expensive, but don't want to go to the suburbs or regionally, are competing for those apartments. So we've seen a real shift. I actually thought a lot more people would go to the regions this year, but they're going there and saying, oh, it's not that much cheaper. Let's just buy an apartment in Sydney. And so I think that's been a big shift from last year.
Yeah, well, just a couple of points to come back to you. I mean, firstly, you're right on the apartments, right? I separate out in my analysis the sort of the cheaper, you know, Parham High investor apartments, right? I mean, you know, North Ryde, one area, for example, they are really going nowhere. Whereas, in fact, the older style, more spacious apartments, the lower rise apartments, so areas, for example, around Bondi, for example, completely different, right? They've definitely moved up. So again, you have to go granular, as we keep saying, as you know, this is one of our big mantras, isn't it? You have to go granularly. You can't just sort of talk generically. And if I talk about the area around here, Austenmere, which is just a couple of suburbs up, right? That suburb has gone amazingly strong for houses, right? So I've seen prices 40-45% higher than they were, you know, 12-18 months ago. It means that the locals are priced out completely now, right? They can't afford to buy there, so they're having to look now closer down to Wollongong, where the price pressures have not risen so strongly, in probably less salubrious areas. So Austenmere was a little bit of a sort of a quiet jewel. Well, it's now been discovered, I can tell you that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's. I mean, we've spoken about your area, and it could be a, you know, all about Martin North, sort of the rural pocket, but it is one of those special pockets where it is piggybacking off sort of Sydney. It's actually really in Sydney. It's, you know, it's commutable. It's got a train line. It's got the escarpment, very limited supply, lifestyle. I particularly prefer, you know, a bit further south, you know, the rural Bulleye, you know, you've got the schools, easier way to get out to the freeway, et cetera. So, but yeah, I mean, it's still comparable for the Sydney families who say, well, we want lifestyle, we want to bring up our kids somewhere. And, you know, when they look at that compared to what they can get in the city, they go, well, it's actually fair value in comparison. And it might not have been what people wanted to pay prior to COVID, but now people are saying, well, actually, you know what, we can make that work because I can work from home 2 or 3 days. So I think there's still a bit more legs down there for you.
Yeah, somebody said we don't all live in Sydney. No, indeed. No, we're not just going to talk about Sydney. We're going to talk more broadly as well. And one of the interesting pieces of analysis I've done recently is I went back to Mandurah again and looked at what's been happening on over there, right? Because, of course, everybody in Perth had been saying massive price rises, you know, everything's turned around, right? Well, I can tell you, prices in Mandurah were still higher in 2012-13. We've still got a lot of people with negative equity, and we've still got people who are stuck on large mortgages with higher interest rates because they can't refinance out. Now, this whole concept of mortgage prisoners, Chris, is something I want to explore with you a little bit, because I think we do see this in a number of pockets around the country even now, and it can be quite dramatically pressurizing on households, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, the real problem is when you take out a mortgage and you can't refinance it. So you might not be able to refinance for two reasons. One, an equity problem. So the price of that property's fallen, or you borrowed at 90% and the property hasn't gone up in value. And so you can't refinance to another bank. Or for something's happened to your income, or, you haven't got a bonus, or your partner's not working, you know, or you've had to maybe be redundant or something like that. Finally, it could be bank policy. This caught a lot of people out in that 2014 post-APRA, tightening in that period there, where you could borrow, you know, maybe 10, 12 times income, which is crazy. And they really tightened up on investors. And so we saw a big problem where a lot of people went to non-banks because they could borrow more money there in terms of the way the calculators were. And then they got stuck on higher rates in properties that they can't refinance out. And so it is a real challenge. And if you are pushing your servicing, you've got to be really careful that you don't get stuck at a bank and then their policy changes and income changes, because if they do have to lift their rates for some reason, you can get stuck on a high rate and you don't want to sell it anyway because you've got negative equity. It can get pretty messy quite fast.
Absolutely. And somebody was saying, well, Mandurah is not in Perth. No, it's south of Perth, but it's a bit of a leading indicator of what's been going on. Mandurah went into mortgage stress quite a long time before others. And in fact, Otto has just put a very interesting tweet up, and I agree, post up, I should say. The mortgage prisoner of Mandurah is a vision for the future. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that this is actually a bit of a sort of a leading edge. Now, I know closer into Perth, there are different stories, although there, actually, what you find is that some of those price movements, which were quite strong, have eased out. And if you compare the price movements up with what happened previously, they're still lower than they were a few years ago, right? So if you take a longer term view on these things, maybe that gives you a different perspective. And of course, Melbourne is behaving differently in different parts of Melbourne. And it goes back to what we keep saying about different parts of the country, different types of property behaving very differently. Let me talk about a bit more specifically about buyer demand, Chris. And one of the questions I've got for you, and it's come up in a couple of pre-submitted questions too, is: are people having to compromise to buy basically lesser class assets now because they want to get into the market, and that's all that's there? Are you seeing that?
I think we were seeing that a lot in the start of this year, where people were just everything they can just to get into the market. I noticed in the last 3 months, people have definitely taking a chill pill, I guess, and taking a deep breath. And the quality assets, things that are on good streets, good aspect, good privacy, good block, surrounded by other houses, closer to the train, all these sort of things, which aren't that quite rare to find because people don't really want to sell them. People are still going all in on those because they're going, well, look, it's the area we want to be in, it's the street we want to be in, rates are low, let's just go for it. And so you can see that with the auction results. We had a couple of clients buy these in the last week, and they had to pay top dollar for them, but ultimately they're good assets. But I think a lot of clients are being very patient. We've had pre-approvals that are just really taking a long time for people to buy, and it's because they're just getting really nervous about paying a big price for a poor asset. And so they've not got that sort of desperation there. We're also seeing some first home buyers and investors actually just deciding not to go ahead. So whether it's because they've gone to market, they've been blown out at an auction or two, and they're just like, this is not for me. I'm just going to keep on saving, which is sometimes a good option for first home buyers because one, they can increase their deposit, which can increase their purchase price and give them more options in the future. Their incomes can change quite dramatically, quite fast. that can give them more options. And so sometimes when it's trying to force it for first home buyers, it's sometimes best to step away, reassess, keep, and then just, you know, and make a new strategy on, you know, in 6-12 months time. And so the investors are the funny one, I think, because you know, they go, I want to buy a longer term investment and I'm going to hold it for 30 or 40 years. And they see that prices have moved a bit and they say, oh, no, I'm out. And then, you know, they might come back 2 or 3 years later and say, I want to buy another investment. But, you know, they've got to hold it for 30 or 40 years. It's about getting a quality asset and paying a decent price. And so, you know, hoping for a market to fall or something for an investors on a quality asset is a bit wishful thinking, I think. So, but we are seeing it. We're seeing investors pull out. I also think upgraders are, you know, not entering the market because of low listings. And so that's not coming into the market at the moment, where they're not sort of saying, I'm going to gamble, I'm going to sell my place first, or I'm going to buy first, just because there's not many things that they really want because of the quality of listings. So, yeah.
Okay, very interesting. And picking up from that, Cookie Boy asked the obvious next question. What about mortgage refinancing? You know, is that happening, or is that easing back now? Rates are moving up slightly in the longer term fixed rates. There was a huge rush to refinance down when rates were sort of coming down. What are you seeing there, Chris?
Yeah, it's nowhere near as much as it was, and it was getting advertised on you know, every TV channel, every bus, etc. There's huge cashback offers, you know, fixed rates well under 2%. So it was a very that headline rate under 2%, I think, was attracting a lot of people. So we're not getting anywhere near as many people coming to us saying they really want to refinance. I think those people who are that like-minded took action last year. And that's what a lot of the refinance sector is sort of, the bank's profits are basically tied to, is people's apathy, right? People just getting a deal, setting up their mortgage, and then just hoping that it's a good rate. And we all know that every year, new customers get better prices than existing customers. So if you're not reviewing your mortgage every year or two, you can very easily fall 20, 30, 40, 50 basis points out of market, which, you know, adds up to a lot of money per year if you keep making those mistakes over, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. So absolutely not that sort of desire for refinancing like it was. When in reality, the variable rates are actually better than they were last year. Yep. You know, we're getting in the 2.3s. Now we've even got a client at 2.2 something at a major bank, you know, last week. So that we were getting 2.4s and 2.5s last year. So variable rates are better this year. Maybe fixed rates are a little bit high, but you can still get amazing 2 and 3 year fixed rates and still get cash back. So it's not like it's any worse than last year. Arguably, it's just as good besides the fixed rate.
Yeah, interesting. And average size of loans is another thing to talk about, right? So we know that the average first time buyer loan is 15 to 16% bigger than it was a year ago. So people are having to take a bigger loan because they're chasing prices up. And the banks seem quite willing to lend. So what's your perspective in terms of lending standards, you know, now compared with a few months ago? And have you seen anything recently changing in terms of the things that banks ask for when it comes to information when they consider a loan?
I think it's, you know, relaxing a bit, to be honest. I think that, you know, there was even a bank came out last week and it's saying we've reinstated to pre-COVID. It's actually the policy is exactly the same as it was. And so we're not really seeing any real decline loans. I mean, it's sometimes down to the assessor at a bank, to be honest. A lot of the banks, you can see through all mortgage data that there's been a huge influx in application. You know, every aggregator is showing volumes up dramatically. Every bank's, you know, amount of loans they're doing is up a lot. So to process all those loans, they had to have people here, and offshore was a big problem for all the banks with assessors and lockdowns and training, etc. So we found that the quality assessors at the banks has fallen dramatically. And sometimes it's down to the assessor, you know, just their experience. And they're asking a lot of questions because they don't know what they're doing, to be honest. And so, but overall, the actual policy itself is relaxing. And we're not seeing the big elephant in the room is always around living expenses. You know, a bank's going to go back to like they were in the Royal Commission and go forensically through applications and people were spending, and they're definitely not doing that. So, you know, the HEM maybe is up a bit, but even bonuses can be 100%. 1 year financials was a big change. You know, a lot of the banks in COVID went to the last 2 years, but now a lot of them are going back and saying, well, only the last 12 months is fine. I just want to look at that. Some are still wanting to see BAS's for self-employed, which is a, you know, is it makes it a bit tougher than it was prior to COVID. So I would say it's relaxing. I wouldn't say it's to the same as pre-COVID, but I don't think that's a, you know, I don't think there's any crazy credit decisions happening where they're trying to decline loans. I think all banks want to grow their credit book.
Yes, it was the main game in town. And what about the difference between the non-banks and the majors? It looks to me as though non-banks have very cheap funding available at the moment, I guess because the securitization rates are so low. And they seem to be a little bit more willing to perhaps go out foot on the limb as well. So you know, non-banks seem to be growing their share.
Yeah, and I'm all for it. Online banks, non-banks, you know, bringing more competition to the mortgage market is great. You know, we need to keep the big four have got a lion's share. You know, it could be 80% of the loans some way goes through them. So more competition, the better. And they are absolutely getting cheap funding. You can see the Ubanks. I mean, that is NAB, but, you know, Athena, TikTok, you know, all these sort of online lenders. Plus, you've got your non-banks, you know, all offering rates in the low twos. You just got to be very careful when you're using some type of funding provider that only has a limited number of, you know, funding lines. And if their funding lines change or wholesale funding goes up, you know, and their business profitability drops or something like that, can you easily refinance? And if you can easily refinance your loan to another lender, then you've got nothing to worry about. You can take advantage of this rate. While it's good, it's good. And if it doesn't, you know, do what you need it to do, it goes up on you, then you just refinance to another bank. So you just got to be very careful using these lenders when you may have to refinance and you can't for some reason, then you just don't want to get stuck, which is that issue we spoke about at the start.
Absolutely.
They have got very vanilla policies just for people to be aware of, just because of the way that they get their funding. You know, they can't do lots of different things that other banks can do because they've got to have very vanilla applications to satisfy their funding providers. So anything that's a little bit grey or a little bit more risky, you know, potentially they won't even consider you as a customer. So you just got to be aware of that with these lenders.
Absolutely. It is worth doing your homework and also just make sure that you understand the difference between the advertised rate and the effective rate, right? Because sometimes it's not anything like the same. And unfortunately, I've spoken to a few people over the last few weeks who thought they were getting one rate, but when they actually took into account all of the fees and charges and everything else, they've actually ended up with a much higher rate. And in each case, it was actually the non-bank lender that actually, not tricked them exactly, but just the way that the information was displayed wasn't the full picture. So I always say to people, make sure you understand the difference between the advertised headline rate and the real effective rate, because you can make a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all our clients go through on package loans at the banks, which is, you know, around about $400 a year, and, you know, setting up or exiting's not that, very similar. They're all got a very similar product. But if you start stepping away from those package loans at all the different lenders, you've got application fees, you've got account fees, you've got, you know, et cetera. So you can very easily add up, especially on smaller loans, those fees can add up. So, you know, and make a big difference to your overall interest rate.
Absolutely. So do the homework. Now, this is a very much, I think, a plea from the heart here from Bougie, who said, even with $450,000 in savings, I think I've been outpriced from the Western Sydney market. Low quality assets, top dollar, and don't want a massive mortgage. I hear that story again and again and again from people who are trying to work out what to do in the current environment, right? It's very tricky.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's a few parts to that. I mean, there's, you know, why do you want a low mortgage? I guess if it's getting to the retirement age, or if it's just that sort of feeling of having a low mortgage. So, you know, that's probably part of it as well. I mean, it's hard to really know. I mean, I guess it's if there's major changes with work or income, et cetera. I mean, as you can move to other areas, we're seeing that as well, where clients potentially, it might be outpriced out of Western Sydney, but can they go to Blue Mountains, for example? Or, you know, can you go a bit further away from those suburbs where maybe there's better value? So, it's, you know.
Yeah, so there are a few options Edwin, who sometimes comes on the channel here, makes the point that sometimes if you go a few suburbs further out, the price gradient eases back. And he sometimes says, you know, it might be the better option, right, rather than buying slightly closer. But the other thing about this mortgage question is really interesting, Chris, because I guess, I mean, I'm of an age where I always was taught that having lots of debt was not sensible. You know, basically debt was something that you got when you needed to be able to do something, but then what you do is pay it off quick, right? I haven't frankly got my head around this notion that debt is so cheap now, right? That actually, you know, debt is okay, and in fact, more debt could be better. Convince me that that's the case.
So I'm not going to be able to convince you that credit card debt is good. You know, that's pretty, you know, or getting debt to buy a car or, you know, that sort of consumer debt, right? But ultimately, you know, Australian house prices are Australia's biggest asset and they're banking profits, lots of different reasons, right? And so the system basically is trying to pump up house prices for lots of different reasons. The government benefits from stamp duty, land tax, council rates, the list goes on. And so it's about sort of saying, well, if I can use this debt and I can service this debt, a lot of people think they have to pay it off. And yes, you should, and you should want to do that, but you can pay off your debt at any point in time. You just got to sell the property. And so you've got to also just, you know, and that could be an option. You could, you know, I get in the next 20 years, I'll have a lot of debt, but then I'll sell that property, use the net equity and then downsize. And so you just got to be a bit careful. I mean, you can be conservative and say, look, I don't want that cash flow. I don't want that burden. But when rates are low, you create basically momentum behind the market. You create asset price inflation. Why don't we do it? And so you can sit on the sidelines and say, I'm not going to be part of the system because I don't believe in that and debt's bad and this is the bad for the Australian economy, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that asset prices are going to do what you want. And so basically the people who have gone and taken on the debt are the ones who have got the biggest financial rewards, et cetera. So, yeah, it's kind of how you're sort of understanding and you're willing to be part of that system, even though you might not agree with it because of all the negatives that house prices and asset price inflation causes, you know, whether it's homelessness or inequality, there's lots of different things. But the reality is, I think what you'll find is that longer rates stay low. This is not just an Australian thing. This is a global thing that's happening. Low rates encourages people to take on debt and more debt than they would want to take on. And debt is what drives the asset prices going up, especially property. And so, you know, if you think that rates are going to stay low, you think you're going to ultimately have a shortage of supply of that top quality asset where they cannot build any more of them. And we're going to have population growth. We have demographics, people getting born today. They'll be buying houses in 30 years' time. People living longer, ultimately. And as people get older, they do well financially, whether they've got a business or they get savings. Ultimately, a lot of that money flows back into property. Because lifestyle is what they're trying to buy. You know, you only get one life, et cetera. So, you know, you can sit on the sidelines and say, look, I just want to pay my mortgage off, which we get all the time clients doing that. But when rates are low, potentially having a bigger mortgage is going to get a more net financial wealth for you, which is going to give you more security in the future. So I personally think it should be a tool that you just got to be carefully how you use it, like a credit card. I mean, there's no real good way to use a credit card, but it can be a tool that's good. I absolutely hate credit cards, but if you buy it today and you pay it off in 55 days, well, technically there's a small benefit there and potentially you could have some points, et cetera. It's the same as, you know, taking out a mortgage. You know, if you do take out a bigger mortgage than you're hoping to, you want to make sure there's a quality asset behind it that you sell one day that you're going to get that money back because you bought well. And I see a lot of people take on huge mortgages, take huge risks, but ultimately the quality of properties behind them, I think you're just wasting it, you know, and you're giving yourself stress. You're not going to be able to sleep at night. You're getting no reward from it. And you've got a big mortgage. I think they're the ones who are shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think you and I probably have a different perspective here. Maybe it's a generational thing, right? You know, my dad was a bank manager. And so I've been schooled into thinking that debt is something you take when you have to take it. You're very cautious about how much you commit to and you get rid of it quick, right? Now, I think there is another generation or two that say, no, debt's fine. You know, we get encouraged to take debt from HECS. we basically get debt from credit cards, we get debt from mortgages, it's just part of the furniture. And then the question, of course, is can you control the debt? Can you manage it? Or does it effectively get the better of you? And the problem, as I see, Chris, is that there are some people who can manage this well and benefit the way you said. You know, they ride the value of the property up, and over time the property increases relative to the pool of debt that they've got, and therefore they're actually doing well. But I do see other people that are trapped because they've bought the wrong asset to start with. They've committed themselves to too much debt, and then either because of life changes or simply because of, you know, circumstances that just happens from time to time, they are unable then to manage that debt. And unfortunately, I'm seeing more in that second category than I would like to see at the moment, even now with rates so low, with the question, of course, what happens when rates go up. So I think that this, you know, I'm not sure whether there's a middle ground, but it does seem to me there is an interesting philosophical point here about debt, how to use it, how to use it well. And I, at least I think it's a debate that there should be had more about for people, rather than just the automatic assumption that I get the biggest mortgage that I can to buy the biggest property I can, without necessarily thinking through some of the issues that you touched on.
Yeah, so you've got the home buyers taking on a lot of debt, which is, we've seen people absolutely get hamstrung. Basically, they've borrowed a lot of money, assuming bonuses are going to keep on coming in. Maybe they've started to have kids, and maybe one partner's not working, or is working part time. Maybe they got made redundant, and then they're living a pretty extravagant life, and they're spending a lot of money. And what we've seen is their debt's just sitting much going sideways. And when rates are high, they're wasting a lot of money on interest, etc. And so we've seen those people before in the past, and they're super stressed. They can't quit their jobs. They're stuck in a job that they don't like, and the pressure and relationship breakdown, etc. And we've seen that. So I think you can definitely do that around home ownership. I think I'm more worried about, as long as they've bought a good asset, potentially they've been saved by that, to be honest. But a lot of people have bought, the poorer street, the darker properties, etc. So A, they've got all the stress, but B, they're not going to get the financial rewards unless they sell in a super hot market when everyone's desperate, like maybe March, etc., or maybe the height of 2017, etc. The investors are the ones I really see that, the people who are really coming to us and saying, oh, can you maximize my borrowing capacity? I've already got four properties. I can get 700 grand at the banks. Can we go to a non-bank so I can get 850? And then they're sort of doing something tricky with their income and maybe playing with a second job. And they're really trying to stretch it to the nth degree. They're the ones, and they've got no buffers. If anything happens to any of their properties or their jobs or their work, or one property falls, they can't refinance. For me, not only are they usually buying poor assets, because when they've got enough capacity to buy another property, they go and buy another property. And because it's only a little bit extra capacity, it might be 300 grand, they have to buy a 300 grand property, and that adds on to their seven other $200,000-$300,000 properties that have done nothing. And so the best sort of investors, I think, are the much more conservative ones. They've, they've paid off their mortgage, they've built up some equity, they've got a bit of borrowing capacity, they go and buy one quality asset, they do that for a few more years, and they buy another one 3 or 4 years later. They're the ones over the last 8 years looking at thousands of portfolios that have done the best. They've just accumulated a few properties over that time, and haven't really stretched things to the nth degree, just buying cheap and cheerful properties.
Absolutely. And, I don't think that you'll get a unified view on this. I've got a few people in the chat saying, debt is, something to be concerned about. Look, all I would say is I want people to really, make sensible decisions on full information, right? So I'm always scared by how many people have no sense of cash flow. So they really don't know what's coming in, what's going out. And they sort of assume that if the bank says, sure, you can have the mortgage, then they can have the mortgage, right? Never mind what the real situation is with their finances, right? So I think that's one indicator. The second indicator is, the multiple leveraged household. I come across this quite often in my one-on-one conversations, where they've got their main property, the residence, and then they've leveraged that into an investment property, or three or four or five or six, and they're all sort of cross-leveraged with each other, right? And then you start sort of teasing back the amount of debt that's in the system relative to the assets and the risk that are there. Those are the things that I think probably worry me more.
Yeah, and I think through your conversations, Martin, correct me if I'm wrong, but it would be their one asset, their home, that has done quite well for them, and they've held it for a long time, and that's doubled or tripled. Maybe one of their investment properties has done well because they've probably held it for maybe 10 years plus, and it's done well if you look at it on a number basis. Maybe it's gone from 3 to 4.50 or something. But when you look at a percentage basis and their costs and their maintenance, it probably hasn't done that well. And then there's two or three that have just not done well at all. And those two or three, they've probably got a lot of debt because they've bought them in the last 2 or 3 years. And if you take those away, strip their portfolio back, it's usually, you know, maybe one asset, their home's done well. Maybe one of their investment properties done average because they bought it, you know, pre-2010 or something. And so, yeah, that's sort of it's always interesting. I do worry that those people who just go out and try to build a portfolio and just focus on the number of properties, I never see it really working.
Yeah, absolutely. It is about, you know, being cautious. And you're right. Almost always it's the, whoa, that was easy. Let's go buy another investment property. And then you don't buy the right one, right? And I've also had a number of people say, well, I've now got vacancies, right? I've got vacancies in my rental properties I didn't expect to have because, of course, the gross yield is quoted as on a assumed full rental return basis. But if you've got vacancies, then it blows it up completely. So, again, I think it's a matter of people being cautious. But I guess, you know, my position on the pendulum of debt is I'm probably less positive towards debt because I see the damage it does to so many people and I see what damage it does to the broader economy. And we're blowing this house price. And I guess the question for you, Chris, is, so at what point do properties become too expensive?
I guess it's, you know, I do think that there'll be a point in time where there'll be a social problem brewing more and more, you know, as first home buyers in particular can't afford to buy. This is what this whole 5% deposit scheme is. It's about sort of, you know, as if only people can buy them, say investors, the ownership rate keeps falling, you start to create a problem in society, which has already arguably happened, and you've got homelessness, etc. So I think you've got that problem, and hence why there's got to be more affordable housing, especially for key workers, etc. So can the top end keep on getting more expensive? I think it can. You know, the reality is there's a lot of global wealth out there. You know, migration will come back. There'll be a lot of people overseas looking at sort of the premium end of our markets, and, you know, people wanting to move here with bringing big deposits over, earning good money here. So, yeah, it's that's priced as a different thing because it's priced on scarcity when there's only so many of them and there's more and more demand, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a challenge where the overall market becomes too expensive for the locals. You create a social issue, obviously, which is obviously something the government's trying to, they're never really trying to solve it, to be honest, because they're always just trying to create more demand, i.e. 5% deposits. One thing I was going to say around cash flow, I think 2020 was a real reset for especially sort of the younger generation, where, you know, we do know how to spend money, whether it's, you know, the cafes, the restaurants, international travel, you know, online shopping, etc. You know, every generation knows how to spend, but I'd say that, you know, the younger generation know how to enjoy themselves. And we found a lot of clients that were earning good incomes but were never really able to save. You know, the reality is there was too much on offer in the world, and I think in 2020 there was nothing on offer. You couldn't travel, you couldn't go out, so you couldn't go to the restaurants, etc. And couples and, you know, singles basically said, well, let's just really focus on my cash flow and see how much money I can save. And hopefully a lot of those habits will sort of, you know, continue. And that's giving people a lot of confidence to go and, you know, get mortgages. We've seen a lot of clients that had nothing 12 months ago, and all of a sudden they've, you know, got some deposit. They've tapped on the shoulder of family, and then that's helped them with their deposit. And they've created a new sort of lifestyle for themselves. It's sort of, and then they've got a mortgage, and then they've got that restriction there, which is forcing them to save, et cetera. So I think cash flow was a, you know, reset a lot in 2020 for a lot of people because they had to change their lifestyle. And so, yeah, well, time will tell.
Yeah, well, cash flow is interesting. And, you know, I run my stress surveys, and we've got a lot of people whose cash flow is pretty dicey at the moment. And that's partly because no income growth, more part-time work than full-time work, and all those sorts of things are there. There are others, though, doing really well. And, you know, we've got this sort of two-speed economy, right? We've got some people doing really well, and, you know, everything's fine, and they're able to sort of keep that debt cycle running, and, you know, but others aren't. And the inequality that actually, you know, generates is a concern to me, I think. But we'll see. Now, I've got another question for you, and this is from Lukey. Is it better to buy now before the stamp duty changes? I guess we're talking here in New South Wales because they're looking to sort of rejig and, you know, replace stamp duty with land tax, as it were. What's your perspective on the impact of that? And you know, does it really make a difference? Will it make a difference? And how should people think about it?
I mean, the state government's already said that they think transactions are going to go up by about 50%. This is the volume of properties sold. And every time a property is sold, it's a debt-creating event. That's the reality what it is. The person buying the property generally, unless it's a downsizer, takes on more debt than the person selling the property. So you create more demand in the system, and then people go back into the market and borrow more money. Generally, that's what happens. Whether you're selling an apartment, you upgrade to buy a house, or you're a first-time buyer, you're an investor, that's new debt into the system. So ultimately, as more transactions happen post this stamp duty change, and it makes sense. If you think about it, you're a first-time buyer, you only have to save for the deposit now. You don't have to save for the stamp duty. So you've gone from a 15% deposit, let's say, that you need to a 10% deposit. So on $1 million property, you need to save to $100,000 now, not $150,000. Do you think that's going to create more demand? Absolutely. For investors, for flippers, et cetera. So, and you will see a lag with listings. You know, listings don't all of a sudden hit the market. So you see increase in demand, pretty much like what happened in the start of this year, with a very little slow rise of listings. And so, you know, I think you'll find that the prices will rise way more than 5% very quickly. And so, yeah, you might not pay stamp duty, but you're going to pay a higher purchase price. The reality is this isn't guaranteed as well. You could sit on the sidelines waiting 2 or 3 years for this land tax change, and it could never even happen. Nothing's guaranteed yet. So you've got also to be concerned about that. The government said something about a 25%, 25 grand for first home buyers a month ago. I sort of read it in the paper, I'm sure, and then I've heard nothing else about it. I was like, they just dangled the carrot and changed their mind. So, yeah, I wouldn't be waiting for some stamp duty potential change, hoping that you're going to get also the same property prices today. I think you'll find property prices will be more, et cetera. And ultimately, it will continue to create more demand for the market because everyone times they go, oh, you know what, let's upgrade our house. You know, let's take on an extra 200 grand in mortgage. We don't have to pay stamp duty. And that's what the state government knows. So, yeah, it's not there for your interests. It's for pumping up property prices.
Yeah, pumping up property prices. There's a lot of that going on. A lot of people want that to continue. You know, it's a fascinating situation. With regard to the stamp duty thing, I just remind people that the problem with the land tax is that the rate can change later, right? So you actually have no real transparency as to what you could be paying 10 years down the track. At least with stamp duty, you know what you paid because you paid at the time. So you are effectively turning yourself into a cash flow into the future for the New South Wales government. I'm sure they will love that, right? And of course, banks want cash flow, so that's why they want mortgage repayments. The real estate sector like it because, of course, it drives more momentum. And the state government can then say, well, I can now be clearer about what my cash flow is, and it's going to be less volatile than the stamp duty, because stamp duty goes up, you know, when things are fast, but it drops back when things slow. I mean, it's what, $9 billion, I think, is sort of roughly where it is at the peak, drops dramatically. So it gives the New South Wales government more certainty on cash flow, but actually individuals have less certainty.
Yeah, but I mean, most people only live in a property, let's say 7 to 10 years. Investors are actually less than that because they, most of the time, they stuff it up, to be honest. And so, you know, if you hold your property for 7 years on $2,000 a year, that's a lot, or $2,000 or $3,000 a year, it's a lot less than, say, the $50,000 that you have to pay. I think, you know, even you might not have certainty, there's going to always be a limit, a social problem. You know, like lifting rents, you know, can they lift annual land tax that much without people out the front with sort of sticks, you know, rioting? So I would say that I think it's going to be a good thing for people buying, to be honest. You're going to have a lot less cost than stamp duty, but it's not going to create lower prices. It's going to create higher prices. And I think that's what people need to sort of think about.
Factor in, yeah, supply demand. Now, just coming back to Butchie's comment, you asked, put it back on the screen, essentially a first-time buyer with 460K savings, shit scared of a 600K mortgage to get a basic property. So it's the quantum of the debt that's the real haunting. You know, it's a big number, right? And that's obviously relative to income and those sorts of things. I mean, it's worth people thinking hard about that sort of commitment, I guess. But,
you'd be scared of a mortgage. I guess it's probably what you're scared of, the monthly repayment. So if you're scared of a monthly repayment, are you scared of it at the current interest rates, or are you scared if interest rates go up? And so what you could say is, okay, well, let's say rates went to 4%. And that would be that maybe the RBA lifted to 2%, right, which would be a big increase and would suck a lot of consumer demand out of the economy. Imagine all this debt that has been created. But let's say it did happen, right? There was an inflation outbreak, US increased rates. 4% on a $6,000 mortgage is around $24,000 a year of interest. You add capital on top of that, maybe another 40%. So maybe your repayments are $3,000 a month, and maybe they would have been half that. So that's about, $35,000 a year. I guess it depends on what your income is and what do you do for work and do you love your job? I mean, you won't want to take a $600,000 mortgage if you hate your job and you want to do a career change, et cetera. So, are you scared of the actual rising rates, or are you scared of the job that you don't like and taking on a debt because you don't want to do a job that you hate? So I don't think you've got to have to pay a cost to live somewhere, right? So there's going to be a rental cost there that you're going to have to pay. So if you minus that off your mortgage repayment, what's the real difference? We said $3,000 a month. What are you paying in rent? $400 a week. So maybe it's an extra $1,000 a month if rates go to 4%. So, I don't think, mortgages would be scared of, A, if rates are going up, or B, you're taking on too much, or C, you hate your job really, or you're really worried about your job prospects.
Yeah, and it's those external factors, right, which, we can't really take much further in this conversation. But those are the sorts of questions that people need to think about. And I always say to people, run the counterfactual. If you're thinking of building this particular future, well, what happens if this goes wrong or that goes wrong? And so at least you've thought through the scenarios and the risks so that you've got some sense of what you would do, because the trouble is that if you actually go in holus bolus and then something changes, you've not thought about it, you can actually get trapped. And when you get trapped, you often have to make bad decisions, and you often end up, not making financially the most smart decisions off the back of it. So I think, thinking on the way in is good.
Yeah, ultimately as well, it's got to come down to the type of property you purchase. Even a client today, they were, so I just want to buy a house. It doesn't matter if it goes up, I just want to live there, etc. For me, it's like warning signs all over it. It's like, no, you buy $1 million investment, let's call it. And you are going to sell it one day. You're not going to live there forever. At some point, even if you die, you're going to have to give it to your kids, or you're going to have to pay out a mortgage. You definitely need to make sure you're buying a quality investment. You're not just buying a house just to live in it. And that mindset, I think, is really dangerous, because ultimately, you then potentially don't matter if it's a quality asset. You don't matter if it's dark. At some point when you go and sell that property, you either got a supply problem. Let's say you buy a new house and land package in the fringes. Well, now you've got all these other new house and land packages that are brand new and they're the same price as yours. And there's other people trying to sell yours because there's a downturn in the economy. And, we can already see through your stress surveys that, they do hit sort of those areas a bit harder. And so, you just always got to be thinking, am I buying a quality asset? How would this sell? Who would I sell it to? What markets does it appeal to? How scarce is it within this market? And focus on that, as well as making sure you can afford the mortgage, because having an affordable mortgage isn't going to protect you from an asset value point of view. And you can easily see price falls, which we've seen in lots of different areas. So really focus on the asset quality, as well as making sure you don't go into, too much debt or debt you can't afford.
Yeah, now a long, long litany of questions, but really, really important questions that people, I think, unfortunately, often don't necessarily think through. Let me just make this comment. Smooth Opera says, why can't I make a Super Chat payment? Well, other people are, so I don't think it's the system. So give it another go, Smooth, see what you can do. I will just say, AI, thank you very much for this interesting conversation here. I might not be here next week, so here it is now. Good debt equals just marketing ploy to make you feel good. Go XRP. Go crypto, right? Okay, there you go. Thank you and appreciate the contribution, there, AI. Interesting conversation point there. Now, I have a whole bunch of questions relating to rate trajectory ahead. And I won't bother to put them all up on the screen because there are so many of them. But what's your perspective, Chris? Yeah, knowing what the Reserve Bank has said, which is that essentially we're going to see rates for the cash rates until 2024, probably no change. You mentioned earlier on the term funding facility coming to an end, and that has some impact on bank funding. And also fixed rates are moving up slightly. What are you telling your clients in terms of how they should plan? What rate rises should they factor in and when?
So we can still see really good 2 years and sometimes 3 year fixed rates, but the 4 year and the 5 year fixed rates are a lot higher than the 2 and the 3. So they're all like mid to high 2% for 4 and 5 year fixed rates, and the 2 and 3 year fixed rates are around sort of that 2% mark. And so, you know, we're saying to clients, you know, when you factor in, when you add up the 2 and 3 year fixed rate over that period, and then you add up the 5 year fixed rate or the 4 year fixed rate over that period, rates have got to rise dramatically, you know, potentially even 1% for that to be better bet. And so we think that, you know, the 2 and 3 year fixed rates are a much better bet than the longer rates. I mean, predicting sort of long-term interest rates is, you know, a hard thing for even the best bond people in the world. And I was in the UK when they went to zero in 2008. So, you know, 13 years ago. And even about 7 years ago, if someone said to me, you know, could you believe rates are still zero? I would have said no. But could I say this is 13 years later and they're still zero? And so ultimately, the world's on this sort of debt binge, governments, corporates, you know, households, etc. Nobody in the world wants rates to rise. Yes, you could see this inflation, etc. happening, but no one in the world wants it to happen. And so can you think, you know, can you protect, yes, maybe protect yourself if rates rises happen in the future, but, you know, are rates going to rise, you know, to 5-6%? Well, if that happens, then you have this huge consumer economy isn't going to survive, et cetera. So, and the banking system, the property system, et cetera. So I would just sort of say, you know, rates are likely to stay low. Like ultimately that's what everyone's saying. So you could be sort of that, you know, play against the market, et cetera. But ultimately I think you're the one that's probably going to lose out. I think you're likely to see rates are likely to stay low. Yes, you are potentially going to see some small rate rises, but you know, even if rates rose say 1%, it's going to have a huge impact on consumer spending, and we're a consumer economy. So I can't see it rising too much.
No, in a way, I think the Reserve Bank knows that if rates were to rise significantly, that would put huge, huge pressure on many people, and it would probably lead to financial instability. One of the reasons why I believe that rates will stay low for quite a long period of time. They'll go up slightly, but not necessarily dramatically. You know, in fact, some of the fixed rates that are still available are actually very good. And, you know, one of my perspectives is, if you are worried about rates rising, there are still ways to fix. And one of the reasons to fix is to give certainty, right? So if you fix for 3 years, you know precisely what you'll be paying for the next 3 years. What you don't know is what happens after that. That's the unknown, right?
Yeah, and so put a buffer on it. So rates are 2.5% now. You know, add an extra percent, say 3.5% in 3 years' time. Can you afford that? Yes. Then, you know, is it likely to happen? I'll probably say no. In 3 years, and you know, RBA saying that, everyone's saying that, the world's on low rates, etc. And so, you know, you've got the exchange rate problems with rising rates, etc. So, yeah, make sure you can afford it at 3.5%, but don't sort of do it at 5 or 6% and thinking rates are going to go up to like they were. If that happened, it would be, and obviously we've got massive wage rises. There's a whole other issue that's happening if rates are rising that fast.
Wage rises, we've forgotten what those are.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting that Phil Lowe made the point that high migration is one of the reasons why wage rises have been very low, right? So in a way, shutting the borders may have an impact, because it might lead to a chance to lift wages a bit. But that's that wouldn't be much use to the politicians who need migration. So I guess, you know, one of the questions I wanted to touch on was, what's your sense on migration? I mean, we know that a few more affluent people have come back from overseas, or indeed have moved here and been able to come through despite the borders. We know that they've been buying top-end property. We know that the mix of migration between Asia, China, and US and Europe has changed. What are you seeing?
We've definitely seen a massive increase over the last, almost since the start of last year with expats buying. We had a client buying in Singapore last week. We had another one in Singapore buy another investment. One buyer bought a future home back here. So I do think ultimately, I think a lot of expats are a bit worried about coming back because trying so hard on the borders, if they sort of the last one to open up and they can, live somewhere else in the world and travel around and they're vaccinated, etc., maybe coming back to Australia is not the right idea now. Still live in London, I'm vaccinated, I'm not that worried. So whereas Australia, who knows when we're going to be there. So I haven't seen the people moving back, but we've definitely seen people, plans have shifted, they're going to come back earlier, they're going to buy their future home, etc. So I think ultimately it's a ticket to the game for the Australian government, whether it's universities, skilled labour, etc., future housing demand, future consumers, tourism, families, all these sort of things. Ultimately, Australia is more desirable this year, you'd have to say, than it was, because of lots of global issues, etc. And I think the government will open that tap pretty fast when they can. They're even getting desperate to try to do it for university students, right? Because they know how much of a cash cow that is. So, I think immigration absolutely will kick off and they'll try to play catch up, And I think what you'll find is that will be a pressure on our inner rings of our capital cities. You don't move to Australia to live in the country. You move to Australia to live in the capital cities to get all the lifestyle benefits. And so while that that pressure hasn't been there as much, I think you'll easily see, the bigger, older apartments will be what they want a lot of the time in around the city. And so a lot of first-time buyers aren't competing with that recent migration at the moment, and they're not really competing with too many investors. So I think that's the real spot is, at the moment, while there's not much migration.
Interesting. Yeah. And I've had some interesting one-on-one conversation with people who are overseas and trying to figure out, get a read on, a particular area, because they're finding it quite hard to get a really good objective information from overseas as to what's going on, right? They've looked at the online portals and the portals don't often give them what they need to know. So it's quite interesting. And you're right. Some people are saying, I'm not sure yet, but I'm pulse checking. So they're sort of checking what's going on and seeing how things are moving and trying to make decisions and planning months and maybe two or three years ahead, because it can take quite a long time to be able to make all of these moves happen. But in some cases, the strategy as well, if I think I'm going to come back over the next two or three years, maybe I should buy ahead of that so I can basically buy, rent, let it out, ride a bit of capital growth, and then when I come back, it's there ready for me. So I'm seeing that happen quite often in my conversations.
Yeah, we're also seeing a lot of people who've done really well through equities. Whether it's they're expats, they're living overseas, they've got a share portfolio. People, even young people who have got work at tech companies, share prices have gone up a lot. And so, or even just people, buying into the market, in the last year or two. And so they've, that's having a huge impact, because as they didn't think they'd have a deposit, but now they do have a deposit. And they go, well, actually, now's a good time, low rates, I want to buy a house, et cetera. So I think the equity market's tied to property prices is at the moment as well. Even things like Bitcoin, we've seen people who've done amazingly well out of Bitcoin. Maybe they haven't sold at the moment, but, they've got eight times their money, and they've put in 50 grand, et cetera. So, those sort of things, like I said before, sometimes will just flow back into property, because those gains then get leveraged. They go to a bank and then that's new money into the property market. And so, that's definitely happening at the moment.
Yeah, I can see you're a leveraged man, Chris. I can see the advantage. And look, it is alluring, isn't it? Right? You put in 20%, the bank lends you 80%, and then prices double, and you've basically made a huge amount. I mean, that's the simple maths, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you might not even put 20% in, right? Like a lot of first-time buyers are borrowing at you know, 90%. So they're buying a $1 million property with, you know, 150,000. So if that $1 million property is now worth 1.4 million, let's say, after cost, they've maybe made 350, let's call it. So their 150 is now 500, which is like triple their money, you know, and tax-free because it's a home. And they might not sell it, they might hold it forever, etc. But absolutely, leverage is something not to be concerned about if you know what you're doing with it and you can afford the mortgage, you know the quality of the asset, which I keep banging on about. But ultimately, that's where it goes wrong. People borrow money. A, maybe they can't afford it, but B, they buy poor assets. And there's not enough focus on that in the property market, whether it's they get attacked by spruikers who very much easily find those people looking to be sold the dream, you know, a high positively cash flow property that's also got amazing growth. And it's, you know, it's going to go up 20% plus the rent's going to go up 20%. And, you know, they sell the dream, but ultimately it's about buying scarce assets, few of those, and using your leverage right. Like yeah, a lot of people aren't doing a great job with it. You know, that's the truth. You know, a lot of people just buy a home and they sit on it and they buy a house in a street and population growth and things do that in time. But investor wise, a lot of people, you know, definitely stuff it up.
Absolutely. Yep. I see the investor stuff up very often in my one-on-ones, yeah. Right? And I tell you what, it is really difficult to unpick, right? What I find really interesting is that often property investors who've gone in with the wrong property on the wrong financial basis and things haven't gone the way they expect, they've almost got to take a loss. And the question is, are they able to swallow that loss? Or do they just hang on by their fingertips and hope that suddenly, magically, things actually will bounce back, right?
Yeah.
And actually, sometimes the most uncomfortable conversation is the one that says, well, you know, maybe cutting your losses is actually the best thing to do.
Yeah, and it is. You know, if it's a high-rise apartment in high density, yeah. If it's a house and land package in the fringes and there's more supply coming, you know, like that Mandurah you spoke about in Perth, if it's a new duplex in southeast Queensland where they're building lots of other duplexes, if it's, you know, outskirts, you know, cheaper property where, you know, it's not that aspirational, it's just targeted at the affordability market. I mean, really, you want to be buying where the family, you know, properties that are suit aspirational higher income to people. So, you know, we had heaps of clients buy in Brisbane, for example, over the last 4 or 5 years. They bought houses, you know, 700,000 to 800,000. You know, all those houses are, you know, gone up, you know, 200,000 to 400,000, right? Like, and you know, are they a good value today? Well, not as much as they were, say, 4 years ago. And so, you know, the same thing in Melbourne. You know, we had lots of clients buy in the inner north of Melbourne, you know, Brunswick and Yarraville and Northcote. You know, they're all low 1 millions and now they're sort of mid 1 millions, you know, etc. So not say that, you know, should you buy them today? Well, no, potentially not. Maybe it's too much, but you know, they're scarce assets. And so that's the real key thing here is the quality of asset you purchase.
Yep.
A lot of people think they know what they're doing, but unfortunately they don't really. Like, they haven't really thought about things deeply from a demand point of view, from a supply, and then at a suburb level, they're always looking for a hotspot or a suburb. They haven't actually thought, well, how does that suburb really work? Where are the rat runs? Where's the school? Where's the main roads? Where's the, you know, the different hills and the lights? And not many people go down to that level, that they just sort of pick a suburb, pick a property, and then she'll be right, mate. And unfortunately, it doesn't work like that when you try to sell one day.
No, well, and you know, that granularity question, right? Again, in my one-on-ones, right? I take people through the planning maps, you know, the zoning maps, right? It amazes me how few people actually look at those. So they actually don't know what's just around the corner, right? Or what's planned. I also show them the flood maps. Another classic example that people don't actually think about, well, hang on, is this low lying? Could it flood, right? And even some of the crime statistics can be quite helpful just in terms of trying to get a characteristic of a particular sub. Now, those are things that are relatively easily available. And yet, you know, so often people haven't thought about it until it's too late. And so they've ended up in an area. There were indicators if they'd realized that would have actually helped them to make a better decision.
Yeah.
And I think you and I would both agree, Chris, that it's the work you do on the way in so that you buy the right property, right, in the right place at the right price. That's probably the biggest decision and the best decision. Because if you buy wrong in the first place, you're always on a slidey slope after that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard yards. It's frustrating. It's stressful. You'll probably have arguments with your partner because it's so emotional and time is draining. Even if you're using a buyer's agent, like, you know, a great buyer's agent that's local specialist, that's been in that market for 5 or 10 years, that's friends with all the agents. Even if you engage them, it's still a super emotional journey buying a property, and you have to say no to most property. And so you're trudging around on a Saturday. Maybe you can't do that right now, but you're going to open homes. You find something, you go and do a building and pest on it, and the building and pest report comes back awful. And you're like, okay, I have to rule it out, you know? Or you find out that something through council that there's going to be something built, which is what you spoke about, Martin, right? No, that's it. Or you find the building hasn't had approved works with a DA. So you don't, next one. Or you go to the property a second time and you go, you know what, there's privacy issues here, or, you know, things that you didn't notice before. And so it's an exhausting thing. Not many people want to do that work. You know, they just want to tick that box, tell people they've got a property, you know, get their parents off their back, you know, tell all their colleagues and friends they've got a property. They don't want to do the hard yards, and that's the reality. And those hard yards do pay off. They don't pay off initially, but they pay off years down the line, and they really pay off when you look to sell. Because A, you'll have agents knocking on your door all the time because they know what your property is, a quality asset, and then they'll be able to sell it in seconds. So it's the easiest commission they'll ever make. And then finally, when you do list the property and you style it, you're the property that, you know, you've got 40 at the first open home, you've got 10 people registered at the auction, and then people that have been waiting to get into that street go hammer and tong, and then you get a big auction price. And they don't do that unless it's that real dream property for them. So absolutely, all the hard yards at the front end, and then you get all the benefits. But not many people want to do those hard yards.
And just to give you a very practical example, right, I moved out of Sydney nearly a decade ago, and we looked at nearly 170 properties, right?
That might be a bit too much, Martin.
Yeah, and we looked in a very large geographic area because, you know, we didn't need to be in any particular area, right? And we were trying to figure them all out. And that process took quite a long time, but, you know, we ended up with actually, you know, a perfect property as a result of it. But when I tell people, you know, that over 100 properties is what we actually went and looked at and kicked the tires on and, you know, looked at the areas, you know, they shake their heads and, what? But, you know, it's important to spend the time, I think. Anyway, that's just my personal...
Absolutely. Like, I think 170 is a good effort. I wonder how long it took you to do that. 18, was that over 12 months or something?
18 months.
And so, yeah. So you've got to be a little bit careful sort of dragging it out that long just because of potentially the opportunity cost of markets moving over that time.
Well, you see, we were lucky because we sold our property in Sydney, right, with a delayed settlement of 18 months.
Okay. So well, you still would have sold at 2012 prices, and then you still would have bought at 2014. You might not have moved for 18 months.
Actually went down a bit. So we managed to pick it just right. But anyway, it is interesting. But
And I mean, I think that's good. So you're right. So that gave you extra pressure to take your time really in, which is a good thing. And that's actually even more reason to be picky in those markets, because there would be a subset of properties that still sell well in those when the markets aren't really, you know, transacting. And it's dangerous buying the properties that's really slow in a slow market, because if they're not selling, it's even like now we're seeing we talked to a client out of buying a property last week, and you know, they were desperate, young couple in Melbourne, they've been looking for ages. They've missed out with reports on lots of properties, and we're really keen on this property. Great suburb, but awful street, awful looking property, really small block of land, can't do anything with the property, doesn't suit the family market, it's just not a great property. 5 out of 10, and they were so in love with it, and she just wanted me to say to them, look, yeah, just, it's okay, just buy it. And ultimately that property isn't going to sell well here, like right now, and it's a hot market. And so how's that going to perform in a really poor market? And so that's a really good sort of sign, you know, if it's still selling well in a poor market, which when I came on here a few years ago, Martin, in that sort of 2018, sort of 2019 decline, you know, a lot of listeners were saying, you know, properties aren't selling that well. And I was like, absolutely. There's this property here that sold on the weekend. Prices are down 15%, but it still sold for more than it did last year. and it still had 30 or 40 people at the open home, and it still had six people in the auction. And so some properties in down markets still perform really well, even sometimes better because there's lower listings. And so, yeah, it's good that you were so patient, because obviously you would have went into a property and said, no, I don't like that about it. And yep. That's fine. Go to the next one. Yep. And you have to be that diligent.
You have to be methodical, diligent, and patient.
Yeah. You're going to start calling this as Chris's rant instead of Edwin's rant, I think he's called it. Says, got on my high horse there, didn't I?
very good. Now, here's an interesting one I want to... affordable housing is still not being addressed. So what is Chris Bates' thoughts on the high demand for affordable housing despite the chronically low supply of affordable housing?
Ultimately, the government it's the government's problem, and they've got to solve it. The way they're going to solve it is they've got to create institutional investment into property. And so you've got to create massive incentives for basically people with cash, probably super funds, to start entering the property market and create this and solve this problem. You know, private investors probably aren't going to do it. The government can't afford to buy trillions of dollars of housing. And so what they probably need to do is encourage people to corporations and super funds, investment funds to build residential housing. So massive tax break, massive incentives. To me, that's the only way that this is going to be solved. You know, other countries around the world do have a lot of institutional and funds into residential. So this sort of build to rent model needs to happen on scale, but the tax system needs to change, and you need to make it enticing for investors to come in.
Yeah, because without the investment structure, it's very hard to find a way forward, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you want to have more housing, more things, and, you know, maybe it's there's the councils give up the way that they make money on sort of releasing land. So it's just, you know, the government's sort of basically got to say, look, we want to solve this problem. We're going to, our solution to this is giving basically incentives and tax breaks and make housing much more affordable. You know, ultimately when you buy an apartment, let's say for, or a house for, you know, $500,000 to $800,000, the amount of tax that actually goes to the government on that new purchase is astronomical. You know, there's lots of reports out there on this. You know, how the developer makes money cutting it up, they make tax there, you know, GST on the build, like so many things, right? Rates, etc. And so the government just needs to basically take a haircut and say, right, we actually really want to solve this problem. We're not going to take all that. We're going to reduce the cost. We're going to make it incentives for super funds and investors to build residential housing. And it's got to be like a build-to-rent model. And the key thing is they've got to make sure the quality is good. There's no point going building a million new homes to, you know, solve this issue if the quality of them is going to start falling down in 15 years and we've got cladding issues and, you know, all those sort of problems that are happening. So they need to build quality assets. And so investors will want that, because if they've got like a build-to-rent model, the person who's building it has got a bigger incentive in making sure it's a quality asset, because they're not just selling it to investors. They're creating an ownership model there. And I think that's what needs to happen on scale.
Yeah, well, certainly the current model isn't working, because we know that the home ownership rates are lower than they were 20, 30 years ago. We know that more people are going into old age with bigger mortgages, which then creates pressure when they try to pay them off when their incomes start you know, deteriorating as they tend to move into retirement. So we've got at the moment a set of policies that have been rolled out for the last 20 odd years, which has succeeded in lifting prices dramatically, lifting debt dramatically, but it hasn't addressed housing affordability, and it hasn't addressed getting more people to own property, right? It's actually going the wrong way.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the reality is they probably need to do some type of zoning changes and et cetera. But my worry with zoning changes is, unless there's control over the quality of stock that gets built, unfortunately, you know, builders and developers will start playing into it, and it's all about sort of reducing the price of it, and then the quality doesn't sort of stack up, and then we sort of just get this perpetuating problem where we're not building things to last. And so you look at cultures and cities around the world, and the housing stock's been around for 400 years. Yep. Things have been around for 10, 15 years, and they look like they're 300, 400 years old. So
exactly.
You know, that's the problem with this sort of zoning thing. I think it needs to be a real effort of building quality. Maybe you get institutional investors and you really try to solve this, and maybe you densify the middle ring, which is not going to make people happy, but that's ultimately what we need to do.
And I'll give you a little tip going back to my earlier conversation about the property we actually settled on, right? It was actually built by a builder to live in it, right? And I think that the quality of construction in the property that he built for his own use is absolutely first class relative to a lot of other stuff that we looked at. So, you know, there's a difference between a builder building quickly just to, you know, pass it on, and a builder putting care into a property that he's going to live in for a period of time, which is what he did.
Absolutely. I mean, it's beware of the flip, right? When you're going out there, and it's a great time to be a property flipper, you know, over the last year, because you could have bought anything. You probably would have, everything's sort of forgiven at the moment, you know, especially maybe earlier this year, not so much now. So you would have bought potentially well in the last year or two. Prices have risen, and then you've done a cheap reno, and you're able to sell it to a desperate buyer. And you've got to be super careful on those sort of cheaper renos. You know, hasn't got that same mindset of what you were talking about, Martin, where he built it, he probably spent a little bit more on the fixtures, the fittings, making sure everything was right, making sure it's a property that's going to last them for a long time. And then obviously something's changed in their circumstances. And you can definitely get those renovated properties that someone's renovated it to live in it, and then they've changed their mind. But they usually get their money back, because, you know, someone can see how much money has been spent. They've done, you know, the more expensive kitchen, they've gone for the more expensive, you know, within reason. Even people potentially overcapitalizing in hot markets get their money back because someone's, you know, falls in love with the reno, where it's something about it.
Yes.
You know, they get punished in down markets a little bit because, you know, it's maybe a bit too more expensive. Yeah, the extra $200,000 or 10%, let's say, is not what people are willing to do for that nicer reno. But in hot markets, a lot of the time they get their money back.
Very good. Now, here's one from Cookie Boy. What do you think about change of government, federal government? Would that change the property market conditions if Labor got back after the next election?
I mean, it could potentially affect investors. I don't think they're going to go ahead with that negative gearing policy again. I don't think it was, I don't think that was the reason they lost the election, but I think it was, you know, part of it, right? Same as, you know, some of the other policies, et cetera. So I don't think they're going to do that, but also it's not really a big, you know, push by investors in the market. So how could they really sort of, could they potentially unwind and go a bit harder on bank policy? Potentially, they don't want to do the responsible lending changes that I think the Libs want to do. So maybe that's, I don't know if that's going to go ahead. I don't know if you've got any extra insights, Martin, but that's all gone cold a little bit. I mean, the major thing was sort of those changes to investors, but that's not what's driving this property boom. You are getting some investors buying in regional locations, et cetera, but this is an owner-occupier boom. All the stats prove that it's owner-occupier lending that's going through the roof. And so even if the government did sort of make some changes to negative gearing or, you know, encourage sort of tighter restrictions on investors, it's not going to slow things down. Ultimately, the Labor want to increase home ownership as well. And so they don't really want to target first home buyers. And
So, you know, my perspective is a bit similar. I don't think they'll do the negative gearing changes. The current wave is definitely not driven by investors, so it's not as speculative as previously. And they want to keep the debt high because they don't want the banks to fall into issues with falling prices. So I think that we're going to find very similar policies.
Yeah.
There probably will be a bit more about affordable housing around the edge and probably more social housing, but you know, I don't think it'll be necessarily mainstream. And the only other point, going back to your idea of using the market to fund the investment for affordable housing, they might be a bit disinclined to do that because that might not necessarily fit within their philosophical mindset, but that would be a relatively minor change. So I'm not sure it's going to make a massive difference.
Yeah, I mean, if the affordable housing, if they want to fund it, I mean, they might say, let's spend $10 billion on affordable housing. It's not even going to scratch the surface of the problem, right, ultimately, and the amount of people in homelessness and the amount of homes you can build for that. And so, you know, they can say they're going to solve that problem with making an effort around it, but I don't think it's going to, you know, really solve the problem. So I think that's why the Liberals don't really want to do it, to be honest, because they know it's not really a solution that's going to solve the problem. And so, yeah, they could potentially just try to use it to win some votes, but it's not really changing the dial.
Exactly. Now, I've got, we're running on close up to the end of the show at 9:20 now. I've got two questions for you, Chris. The first one, somebody asked me specifically about online auctions, right? We are seeing in some places with the lockdowns, particularly in and around Sydney, you know, you can go into a property, but only as a single visitor for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, right? And they're not holding an auction on the property. They're holding it online. I just wondered about your perspective with regard to the psychology of online auctions versus actually being there.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really, you know, been a lot in a lot of them myself, or, you know, a lot of clients. You know, they are something that is sort of not the preference, right? We did do an interview with Damien Cooley on our podcast, The Elephant in the Room. You know, maybe it was about 50 episodes. I think it was episode 125. And we had a lot of conversations around the psychology of it and what's actually going to create that real scarcity and get people that fear of missing out, and the social impact of auctions where someone else is bidding and the pressure. And we've all been to those auctions where the environment of the auction created that competition. That competition is what pushed up the price ultimately. And it's hence why a lot of people with scarce assets really want to run auctions. And so I do think it matters. I think so. I'd probably just listen to that episode, to be honest, Martin. That's probably the best answer I could say, because it's a, you know, if someone like Damien Cooley does, you know, 50 auctions a week, right? And he's been doing it for 15 years. So do the maths on that. What he thinks about it's probably more interesting than me.
Yeah. Okay. Now, very, very, very interesting. Well, you know, I'll just give you the normal flag here that the Elephant in the Room podcast series is brilliant. You and Veronica do a fantastic job there, and got such a broad range of guests and opinions. I've even been on there myself a couple of times, so I can say that. But no, seriously, it's a really good, and it's one of the things I recommend people go subscribe to. There are some very good episodes, including one on there. One other quick question, which a couple of people asked me: pre-approvals for first-time homebuyers. It looks to me as though that's gone off the boil a bit. Is that what you're seeing?
Potentially. I think a lot of first home buyers in that sort of January, they got really burnt late last year. You know, they were getting themselves ready in COVID, and they entered the market, low listings, prices ran so fast, and it was so hard to catch up. And first home buyers are always way more nervous than people who have bought before. It's just natural, right? You haven't done this before, so you've got lots more questions and you're fearful of making a mistake. And so a lot of them got, you know, didn't buy before Christmas. And then the start of this year was just crazy. And a lot of them just, you know, potentially gave up and, you know, or they were keen and they started to look at some properties, et cetera. So we did see a lot of people, A, their pre-approval sort of lapsed, but also people who said they were keen to get pre-approval just decided not to do it. And so, but we have seen, I mean, this is the interesting thing with lockdown. Just in the last 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks, when we've seen a lot of those pre-approvals that we've requested documents from. Maybe we had a conversation earlier in the year, and all of a sudden these documents have ended up in my inbox and they want to get pre-approved. And I do think that's what's happening right now. I think a lot of people are saying, well, actually, you know what? Why don't we get ourselves ready? Why don't we buy a house second half of the year? Some of those conversations which happen at Christmas sort of happening in the middle of the year. It's interesting. There was a real problem with banks getting pre-approvals. You know, they were so busy with refinances and purchases that the turnaround times for pre-approvals were astronomical. That's really come back down. And that probably answers your question there, Martin, that as a whole, as a collective in the market, there probably is a reduction in pre-approvals out there because banks are much faster at processing them now. And you know, we'd be really, with a pre-approval, we sort of had to build a loan scorecard, I guess we call it, where we'll do all the checks that a bank does with pre-approvals. And, you know, because we knew that turnaround times were so ridiculous that, we could have do that. We know the pre-approval was going to be guaranteed anyway. So but even for some clients, we know that it's pointless to get it. We actually say, look, there's no point putting something on your credit file. There's no point getting pre-approval because you could go to any bank. You've got the deposit. You've got the strong income. It's just a piece of paper for you.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And of course, the other thing is that things change, right? So one of the things that I've noticed is sometimes people think they've got a pre-approval, but then they actually realize when you go back to talk to the bank, things have changed and the pre-approval isn't quite worth the paper it was written on.
Oh, absolutely. The banks, you know, they're not that profitable. You know, you think about the time to look at payslips, to check the ID, to look at their bank statements, to make sure they've got the savings, to do the, you know, then send it off to credit to check off. And it's quite manual. It's not automated, right? That's a lot of human hours that the bank has to pay for, right? And, you know, the conversion rate on pre-approvals, I don't know exactly what it is, but, you know, a lot of people get the pre-approval, never buy. A lot of people do the pre-approval with that bank and then go to a different bank to actually when they do purchase. And so a lot of banks are saying, look, we don't really want to do pre-approvals. You know, we're just losing too much money here. However, we'll give you an automated pre-approval. So with the data that you put into the pre-approval, we're not going to verify it. So as long as you put that data in right and everything stacks up with the paperwork, you're pre-approved, but nothing's being verified. And so those pre-approvals are not worth the paper they're written on, because you don't have to make one little mistake with the way that you input it to basically mean that it's invalid. And they're not checking anything. And so they're not, they might be doing a credit check on you, but they're not checking everything else. And so you've got to be really careful about those automated pre-approvals. I also do think you've got to be very careful sort of with a lot of the branch pre-approvals. A lot of branch staff can basically give pre-approvals without any type of sign-off. Those files can get audited by a compliance, the random selection. And so a branch person could give you a pre-approval. They could lodge the loan. It could get approved, but then it could get picked up from audit where they say, hang on a sec, you know, you haven't really done the verification here. And so we have heard those horror stories before in the past where bank branch staff have basically been caught out.
Absolutely. Yep. And just a couple of closing comments from various people. Nefi talked about Keane's paper on housing affordability. Yeah, there's some stuff coming out. In fact, I'll have Steve Keane on the show, not live, but as a recorded in August. That's locked in. It's just a matter of recording it later on. So that will be worth listening to, I think. And Taffy asked, do I still think the issues will occur in September? Well, that's my call. If you look statistically, when markets go down, not property markets, but financial markets, September, October time have tended to be when they go. So we'll see. But I'm still banking. And interestingly, my conversation with Harry Dent the other day, he mentioned September now, because of course Harry keeps moving the deadline. So I won't give too much weight to that. So there you go. Now, Chris, I think we're pretty much done. Any last thoughts from you?
I mean, ultimately, I do think that you're going to see low listings, and I think low listings are going to continue for lots of reasons, people renovating their houses, et cetera. And so, you know, and I think it's just focusing on that asset quality. I think I've banged on a lot about it tonight, but I do think that's the important thing. And so don't get too tricky playing the investment game. But if you are thinking about sort of buying your future home, you know, really think about that and, you know, potentially just try not to get too tricky and try to time markets. We're definitely seeing that at the moment where a lot of people are saying, oh, we're reading lots of things. Markets are end of a massive debt cycle, and I think prices are going to fall. And, you know, if they don't fall or if they do go up, how's that impact on you and your family, et cetera? And so try not to get too tricky with your home. Buy something you can grow into, that you can add value to if you do need to, you know, get more space, et cetera. So hopefully that's a good final thought.
Yeah, thank you very much. Somebody just said, Harry gives me a headache. Yeah, he goes on a bit, doesn't he? No, that's good. Chris, I really appreciate your time tonight. I know the audience has as well. And, you know, what you do so clearly is to highlight, you know, some of the critical questions that people need to go through to think about, right? And I think, if nothing else, you know, you might agree or might not agree with regards to, you know, how important and debt is or what, you know, all those sort of questions. But you've got to ask the questions, right? And that's what I keep saying to people. You know, the most important thing is to ask the right questions and do the work. You know, and it's I keep coming back to the same message, because so often I see mistakes being made when people just try to take shortcuts and cut to the solution without actually doing the work. So, you know, to my mind, the key takeout from tonight is make sure you do the work. So thank you very much once again. We've put the links and things to Wealthful below, so if people want to follow up with you, that's how they do it. And I'm sure we'll have you back on in a few months again to see how this wonderful property market is going to play out.
Yeah, I think we do this every few months, but I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, who knows what's happening with this Sydney lockdown, right? Like, we haven't spoke about that tonight, and how does that sort of play out? And so, is that just going to potentially blow over? Is it potentially going to get a lot worse? How does that impact the economy? So it is going to be an interesting couple of months, which we'll see what happens with listings and demand. And so absolutely, I look forward to a chat in a few months' time.
Yeah, I look forward to it, Chris, and thank you very much for spending your evening. I know that you've had a long day and walked with young kids, but hopefully the chocolate got you through.
Yeah, exactly. The sugar hit before I came on. Cool. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you very much. Cheers. I'm going to take you offline. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye. So there we are. Chris has gone. And thank you all very much for spending some time with me this evening. I think it was a very interesting conversation. As with all of these, you don't have to personally agree, but hopefully it helps to sort of set the agenda and set the thinking patterns for people. That's what this is all about. Now, just before I close, we'll tell you about next week. Next week, Tony LeCown show is scheduled to come. Of course, Tony had to bail out from his previous show, so we expect him to be on next week. It'll be a really interesting conversation with Tony about what we expect ahead. And of course, we'll be able to play LeCantra bingo. You know, I expect to have all of the standard themes coming through, but Tony's always great value, and he'll be able to shed some thoughts in terms of the markets and some of the speculative stocks and everything that you have. And the last point is, you don't have to agree with Chris, but what he's actually representing is a very strong view that's out there amongst many people in the finance and property sector. And so it's quite interesting, educational, just to see how people think. So, and I think there were hopefully some very good points there. So thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening, and I look forward to seeing you all again hopefully next week when Tony LeCantre is on. I'm pretty much done. Thank you very much. Take care. Keep well. For those in lockdown, don't get too rabid. And keep well. Keep safe. We'll see you next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off.